Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives on Optimizing the Diagnosis and Treatment of Patients with Desmoid Tumors, a topic we don't talk about very often. I'm really excited to talk about it today. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Terry Alcender from the Sarcoma Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Harvard Medical School in Boston, and Dr. Myrnal Gounder from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. As always, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more information. Here's where we're heading. We're going to just chat in general a little bit about desmoid tumors, presentation, etc., a little bit about TKIs, but mainly what we want to get into is GSIs, gamma secretase inhibitors, particularly nirogacestat that's now approved. And we'll finish out with a bunch of really great cases that the faculty has put together. So here's a recent review article on desmoid tumors in JAMA Oncology. Really recommend that you check it out. But Myrnal, I just want to take a step back and, you know, without going through a lot of slides, you know, we're just making rounds here today. Can you talk about your vision about particularly the biology of desmoid tumors, why we think they occur, what the metabolic profile is, genomic profile is with these tumors?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Neil. It's always a pleasure to be speaking with you on these great CME programs that you put together. In terms of these desmoid tumors, they are, you know, as you mentioned early on, these are rare, or I would even say ultra rare tumors. The incidence of these tumors are in the United States just about 1,000 patients in the annually. The big picture or the takeaway from these tumors is that they are rarely lethal, and when they are, it's typically in the intra-abdominal areas. So there is a large prevalence of patients, and the incidence keeps, you know, the incidence is about 1,000, but the prevalence increases. These tumors are connective tissue tumors, which means that, you know, they arise from the fibroblasts or myofibroblasts, and they can happen anywhere from head to toe. And they can happen in any age group, from young children, 2-3 years old, all the way to people in their 70s and 80s. So in terms of risk factors, I think I would say the big risk factor here, most of desmoid tumors are sporadic. And when you look at the biology, the vast majority have mutations in beta-catenin. And we think these mutations in beta-catenin, they turn on the Wnt signaling pathway. And it's these Wnt signaling pathway that basically turns on the fibroblasts to keep growing. But in terms of risk factors, one big risk factor, I would say, is having FAP, familial adenomatous polyposis syndrome. So many of these patients who undergo prophylactic colectomies, in the post-operative state, most likely related to some kind of a trauma, post-surgery or something like that, do end up developing a lot of intra-abdominal as well as abdominal wall desmoid tumors as well. So that's sort of a quick overview on this rare disease.
So, Terry, I never know whether it's my lack of knowledge of basic science and everybody else understands all these pathways and I don't. But, you know, here, Myrnal has mentioned beta-catenin. I've heard APC referred to, the Wnt pathway, the Notch pathway. To me, there are a bunch of words. Can you kind of explain your vision about sort of the biology of this process?
Yeah, so I'm not a biologist either, but it's true that, you know, both the Notch pathway and the beta-catenin pathway, they sort of converge into the Wnt pathway. And that explains that one can develop desmoid tumors from diverse etiologies, whether it's an acquired mutation from the beta-catenin, which is the sporadic cases, as Dr. Gounder said, or through the FAP pathway through the APC gene. Another thing that I would add is that one thing that we don't understand is how hormones exert a certain influence on the biology of desmoid tumors. You know, about two-thirds of patients with desmoid tumors are women, and clinicians have long observed that desmoid tumors may grow during pregnancy, may regress after delivery. It's even been found that there were receptors of estrogen on the surface of the desmoid cells. But how do they really influence the progression of the tumor itself is not quite known.
And so we'll get into the issue also of one of the things unusual about this tumor is the fact that it can spontaneously regress. You were referring to that and maybe related pregnancy and other hormone events. And you can just see spontaneous regression. Marinal, I remember when we met the first time, we were looking at some of the placebo-controlled trials, and you saw waterfall plots where it actually went down with no treatment. Any explanation for why you see spontaneous regression and how that ties into whether or not you even treat these patients?
The enigma of desmoid tumor is related to that, to the very heart of your question. I just want to quickly add that, you know, this beta-catenin mutation or this Wnt signaling pathway is uniquely seen here as like a single gene mutation in this disease. So this disease is one where you typically see beta-catenin or an APC mutation. So it's a single driver sort of a mutation. What's interesting is that if you look across all solid tumors, you'll see beta-catenin or APC mutations in colon cancer, liver cancers, and such. And there are some retrospective studies that have shown that if you have a beta-catenin mutation, say in melanoma, you may be inherently resistant to immunotherapies. Same in hepatocellular cancer as well. In HCC, if you have a beta-catenin mutation, APC, you may not respond to immunotherapy compared to, you may do better off with a TKI. And some of this study, you know, that has been around for a bit. In terms of going back to why do these tumors, nearly 20% of these tumors spontaneously regress, the short answer is we don't know. Is it hormonal? Is it some kind of an immune modulation? Is it change in cytokines? We're not 100% sure. But I think we can postulate a couple of things. There was a study that was published by my colleague, Amy Crago, that showed that some of these tumors, it may not be estrogen per se, which is typically associated with pregnancy, but rather all the cytokine changes, the fluid volume changes associated with pregnancy. Typically, you know, there is much higher increase in VEGF during pregnancy. Also, PDGF, this is the platelet-derived growth factors, other placental growth factors. A lot of these things, you know, a lot of these growth factors and cytokines, they're typically involved in wound healing. And since these are fibroblasts, the theory goes that perhaps one of those things, perhaps PDGF or VEGF, may be the ones that's inciting these growth, and it may not be so much hormonal related. And as the pregnancy is done, and the fluid status and everything else recedes, these tumors may also regress. So that may explain, but we don't fully understand. Is this immunological, like a T cell mediated problem? Is it a cytokine problem? People have been trying to study it, and there's some new research looking into it, but we don't have a good explanation.
And we'll get to this later, but, you know, sort of tying into what you're both saying about this sort of hormone connection, there was a really interesting paper presented at ASCO looking at ovarian toxicity with nirogacestat. And so you do see ovarian toxicity with these agents, which is another sort of hormone connection. What about the hope for immunotherapy in sarcomas in general, including desmoid? These are, Terry, generally thought of as very cold tumors. Any thought about whether GSIs could increase immunogenicity or the effect of immunotherapy?
Yeah, so we don't know everything about, I would say, the predictive factors for success in immunotherapy of tumors. Certainly, there are tumors that are obviously infiltrated by immune T cells, and it's no surprise in a way that these tumors should respond. But it's not always clear. There have been data suggesting that a structure called tertiary lymphoid structures, for example, could be predictive of immunotherapy success. In regard to desmoid, as you know, said earlier, we don't really know what are the predictive factors of regression of desmoid tumor. And therefore, you know, the mechanism of an immune reaction to desmoid tumor for now is mostly hypothetical.
Let's talk a little bit about potential interventions that can be done with these tumors. You know, a lot of these are isolated lesions. You would think about local therapies like surgery and radiation therapy. Marinal, can you talk a little bit about, you know, including cryoablation or HIFU as well? But can you talk a little bit about how you strategize about whether or not to use local treatments in desmoid and what situations you do use it?
Yeah. Now, this is a very important question. And I think one of the major takeaways from this is that nearly about 8 years ago, one of the big sort of the shift in the way we start to think about desmoid tumors is understanding that surgery, no matter how great a surgery it is, whether you have a R0 resection or an R1 resection, the risk of recurrence in desmoid tumors, even after an excellent surgery, is very high. And patients usually just end up with symptoms and morbidities that are worse than the disease itself. So I think the one big shift that has happened in the field of desmoid tumors over the last 10 years is that this understanding that we really should not be operating on these patients. At Memorial, our surgeons who used to operate a lot on desmoid tumors now barely operate on these tumors. But I do think there may be a role for, with small volume disease or in favorable locations, one can think about cryoablation and even sort of a transarterial chemoembolization. But I have to say that the data for any of these local therapies is really not there. You know, I think we put drugs and other things at a very high standard, requiring randomized studies. But when it comes to cryoablation, TACE, HIFU, we have not studied this in a manner that the same standard that we hold a drug intervention, and which is really required.
So my support team is probably going to kill me for doing this, but I decided let's just bring in a case here. I just feel like, you know, get into a case so we can kind of get into the real world of how this happens. And Terry, this 65-year-old man, I guess not unusual, by the time he got to you, was maybe a little frustrated that he hadn't been diagnosed. I imagine that's not unrare in these situations. What happened with him?
That's right. So that man had been worked up in an outlying hospital for intermittent abdominal pain and wound up having imaging studies which showed a 5-centimeter masses mesentery. That was suggestive of desmoid fibromatosis. In retrospect, you know, he had had a scan some 6 months before. He was being worked up at that time for possible kidney stones. And 6 months before, there had been a mass already in the mesentery that measured 2.5 centimeters. So over 6 months, that mass doubled in size and was believed to cause the pain that he had. So he underwent a biopsy, which showed a desmoid tumor.
Just kind of curious about his background and how you explained to him what was wrong with him. It's hard enough for me to figure it out.
Well, one thing, you know, is to explain the patient the nature of a desmoid tumor. So it's not cancer. So that's something that's reassuring. But I have personally trouble saying it's benign because, you know, even if in most cases those patients have a favorable evolution, these are tumors that cause problems. Patients can have pain. Patients can be disfigured in the abdomen, especially. They can cause complications such as, you know, perforation, bleeding, abscess formation, what have you. So I have no choice other than agree with the WHO that puts those tumors in the category of intermediate tumors to underscore the fact that they're not cancers, but they're not a tumor that you can just shrug off your shoulder on as you would for a benign tumor.
So, Mirinal, I think you were saying before that these sort of kind of follow a similar pattern to a typical, I guess if there is a typical tumor activating mutation that you said was the beta catecholamine. And I see that this patient actually had an IHC that was positive. Is that the usual case?
Yeah, the nuclear beta catenin, because you can also have cytoplasmic beta catenin that doesn't necessarily confirm the diagnosis. The beta catenin mutation that we see, or the APC mutation, it basically ends up pushing these beta catenin into the nucleus, and that's why the nuclear beta catenin staining by IHC is very important for the correct diagnosis of this disease.
So, Mirinal, Terry wants to know, if, after deep thought about this case, how you likely would take care of the patient. I'd be curious, too, how you would have taken care of the patient like 2 years ago before the DeFi study came out. But what would you be thinking through about this case at this point? Anything else you want to hear about this, Mirinal? Does this sound like somebody who needs to be treated? How much pain was he having from this? How much of a problem was it, Terry?
Yeah, so, you know, I always take the patient's pain seriously. You know, I mean, that tumor measured 5 centimeters, which, you know, you could argue how come is it causing that much pain? But the patient was much bothered by the pain. He had been seeing physicians on a regular basis, so I think that we had to take it seriously. In terms of choice of treatment, so I consider that surveillance or, you know, prudent observation is an active way to manage these patients. It may not be right for everybody, but observation, targeted therapy with either tyrosine kinase inhibitors or nirogacestat, and cytotoxic chemotherapies are all options on the table. And what's going to help you make the decision is, you know, the patient's comorbidities, maybe the rapidity of the growth, the patient's preference in terms of schedule, inconvenience, time toxicity, and so forth. So I went over those options with him that you see on the screen.
So, Mirinal, what would you be thinking? Here are the options that Terry thought about, which we would think about in pretty much every patient. You said the patient was not too excited about getting IV chemotherapy. Terry was concerned about sorafenib, which I guess would have been something you would have considered before the DeFi study, but he went with nirogacestat. Any thoughts, Mirinal?
Yeah, no, I think the first thought process here with really with any desmoid tumor, as you put up, you know, that nice Rodin statue, is to treat or not to treat. And the way I think about these things is, you know, should we take a active observation for X period of time, maybe 3 months, and then get a scan and see what's happening? Or is this a person who needs to be treated right away? And I think there's many different factors. The way I think about this is, one, is the patient symptomatic? And you rightly asked, how symptomatic is this patient? And I agree that we have to believe the patient when they say they're symptomatic. They're here for a reason. That's one. The second thing I would say is it progressing? And if there are signs that this was seen a few months ago and now it has increased in size, that is another reason to argue for treatment sooner than later. And the third thing I would also say, is it in a favorable location or an unfavorable location? This tumor, you know, in the mesentery, if this were to grow, it can potentially cause bowel obstructions, you know, bowel perforation and so on and so forth. So I think this patient has three factors going in for a more immediate treatment rather than a wait and watch observational approach. So personally, I would have said he meets the criteria for an earlier treatment than later. In terms of, you know, which one of these to pick, they're all good. They're all great drugs. I think there's no perfect drug. Everything has its own side effects. Patients have their own preferences and approach to different things. I don't think there's any wrong answer in terms of which one to pick. Of course, if they have comorbidities, you avoid it and go to the other drug. I would say any one of these choices based on the patient's preference is a good choice.
So, you know, the way we do things when people give answers like that, we say, well, what would you likely be doing? And then we ask 20 people and we see if they all say the same thing. So, Marinol, you know, I know you'd have to actually see the patient, but what do you think you would likely recommend for this patient?
It really depends on what the patient wants. Some patients say, you know what, I don't want to take a pill every day. I don't want to take a pill. I forget what day of the week it is. I'm not a type of person who is compliant to take pills twice a day or even once a day. Others say, you know what, I would rather prefer a once a month chemotherapy. It's easier for me to do. I know I'm going to get it done. I know I'm going to do 3 or 6 doses, and then I know a finite time frame when this is happening. Other patients hear the word chemo and they run out and they say, we don't want chemo. We want something that's targeted, right? And so it really depends on the patient's preferences in that sort of an instant. If this patient has any GI side effects, diarrhea or other issues, I would try to avoid drugs like nirogacestat or a gamma secretase inhibitor, which can have some GI side effects. If the tumor is large in the bowel, no matter which drug you use, there can be a risk for a perforation, especially if the bowel and the tumor are very closely aligned. As the tumor gets smaller, it can certainly cause a perforation. So from that perspective, sometimes a drug like sorafenib or a tyrosine kinase inhibitor may not be ideal because they themselves, you know, have this anti-angiogenic properties and we think may cause this perforation. So in that sort of situation, I would go with a gamma secretase or a Doxil. But I think the bottom line is that they're all three are good drugs. They work well, and it really depends on the side effects and the patient preference.
So Terry, I'm curious about your point. It was always interesting to ask people these questions and kind of see how it sort of flows out. I was kind of surprised at how balanced Marinol's view of this situation is, but you tell me. I mean, I see you actually gave the patient nirogacestat, which is what I guess Marinol ended up with. How did you think this thing through? How are you generally thinking it through? And what happened with this patient?
Yeah, I personally would say that my choice was mostly between Doxil or liposomal doxorubicin and nirogacestat. So those were my top two choices. And that patient, among other things, you know, was concerned about that stigma of being on chemotherapy, on receiving a drug that's designed mostly for cancer. So that was his frame of mind. And he also liked the idea of being able to take his medicine at home and having a seemingly, you know, normal life. And then there are also patients who are, and there's nothing wrong with it, who are, you know, attracted by something that's more cutting edge than something that has been around for 40 years. So there are many reasons why patients, when given the choice, select one solution rather than another one.
How did this patient do? I see he had some diarrhea, but you didn't have to adjust the dose. What was his quality of life like, and what happened with the pain?
Yeah, his quality of life was very good, actually. He did have diarrhea once in a while, but I was not even, I would say, I think it's likely that it was caused by the nirogacestat, but it was not constant enough to be problematic. So we decided to treat him as needed with antidiarrheals rather than proceeding with a dose reduction, which was something that he was rather opposed to. His pain, in fact, improved in parallel with the size reduction of the tumor. So as you can see, over a period of 6 months, the tumor shrank by approximately half. So his evolution has been favorable.
So let's move on and talk about some of the data related to this tumor, this situation. But real quick, Marinol, Priya in the chat room wants to know, do you ever see dedifferentiation to high-grade soft tissue sarcomas from desmoid?
Never.
No.
Never.
All right. Well, that was a straightforward one. I like that. Let's talk about what was going on before we had GSIs. where there was really TKIs and particularly sorafenib. And, you know, just maybe to take a step back and say, I was just amazed, first of all, that you could actually do a phase three trial in desmoid to start with. And I know, Terry, that Marino was telling me about the, you know, the support group that really was behind the DeFi trial and how the patient advocates really drove that trial. And I was just actually, I was talking to, we did a program the other day with Marino's colleague, Steve Horowitz, who does peripheral T-cell lymphoma. And that was the first time I saw randomized trials in rare tumors. Like, how did you do that? Where, again, they got the patients involved. So before we start talking about this, just a word about actually being able to do phase three trials in this very rare tumor. Terry, any thoughts about how this evolved? To me, it's an amazing story, particularly the fact that the patient-reported outcomes that were in there.
Yes, so that was amazing. I think that, you know, one strength of that trial was the quality of the phase two data that preceded the design of that phase three trial. So Dr. Gando and colleagues had described the activity of sorafenib in a retrospective study. And they felt that the difference between placebo and active treatment would be big enough to have a valid conclusion with relatively few patients. And having few patients was the only practical way to conduct that study. I mean, this is not breast cancer where you can randomize thousands of patients into arms. You know, as you said, 1,000 patients a year, maybe, in the US, makes it obviously not realistic to randomize hundreds or thousands of patients. The thing, when that trial was performed, I was co-chairing the Canadian sarcoma group, and we were interested in participating. And the success of that trial was such that I think that the trial was opened in Canada for just a few weeks because it was so successful in its enrollment in the US. So trials for rare tumors are possible, but you know, you have to know what you're doing in terms of treatment difference and enrollment rate.
Yeah, Marino, any thoughts? I mean, here we're looking at less than 100 patients, but yet there was such a big difference that you could see it, you know, with a hazard rate of 0.13. This is the part I love, the waterfall plot. I love the waterfall plot for the placebo. That's my favorite.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this study really changed everything. I mean, I think this was a study where, you know, so much of sort of the ecosystem around desmoid tumors came around in order to be able to do studies like DeFi and other studies. I mean, and I have to say that, you know, this observation of sorafenib in desmoid tumors sort of was seen as an anecdote when I was a fellow. We wrote it up, very happy that it went into clinical cancer research. But it was really the patient advocacy group that pushed and pushed and pushed to do a study that will be practice changing, that can potentially lead to some kind of a drug approval. And it was really sort of working with patient advocacy, but also working with the NIH and NCI's alliance cooperative groups, that a study in such a rare disease was feasible. I think in one single day, 80 different centers were IRB approved and opened. And the accrual was unbelievable, the speed at which this study was accrued. And it really goes on to say that, you know, if a drug is active, you know, you will see it in sort of these huge hazard ratios that we see here. But I think it really built an ecosystem to say that, yes, we could do trials in rare diseases. We could do randomized studies in desmoid tumors. And I think everything that the field and the community has learned from it has only sort of moved forward with other drug companies coming into this space.
So, and here's another study looking at another TKI, of course, familiar from a renal cell pazopanib versus chemotherapy. But again, you know, very impressive waterfall plot, response rate. But I guess, Terry, the problem with TKIs, I'm not sure if maybe it's more of a problem with these patients than, for example, renal patients, where, you know, TKIs are a significant problem to start with. But any comment, though, about quality? I mean, the efficacy data looks great, you know, for example, for sorafenib. But what about quality of life with this drug, Terry?
Yeah, you know, it's, I would say, a little bit hit or miss. Some patients don't tolerate these drugs at all. For others, it's going to work if you do some dose modifications. And there are patients who do very well on the original dose. I think that the nice thing that the French trial comparing pazopanib to methotrexate based regimen brought was the fact that we have evidence to choose. These drugs, they are both tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but they're not exactly the same. And it's good to see that, you know, if you cannot have this one, maybe you may try that one. I think that having more choice for the patient makes it particularly relevant.
All right, let's talk about GSIs. You know, we saw nirogacestat approved last November, about a year after the data was first presented at the ESMO meeting 2022, and then published in the New England Journal. Anything you want to say more about what we're understanding about the mechanism of action? We talked before about the Wnt pathway, the Notch pathway, Mernal. Anything else you want to say about GSIs? I know they're looking at it in myeloma, you know, in terms of BCMA cleavage. So it's not, you know, it seems like it's, you know, potentially related to a lot of potential targets. Any comments, Mernal?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a misnomer to call these Notch inhibitors or Wnt inhibitors. These gamma secretase enzymes, there are dozens and dozens, I would say more than 100 different gamma secretase enzymes that play all kinds of different activation and cell signaling in all kinds of different cells, from neural cells all the way to fibroblasts. And this gamma secretase inhibitor, or GSI, basically, you know, stops the cleavage of this gamma secretase enzyme, which starts off many different pathways. These drugs were originally pursued for Alzheimer's disease, you know, more than 25, 30 years ago. And millions of dollars were poured in these huge randomized trials that ultimately went nowhere, were negative. And then they sort of came back to life in oncology. And we looked at in many, many different types of cancers, pancreatic cancer, so on and so forth. But again, didn't show the signal that the drug companies wanted to go. And this whole class of drugs, this entire gamma secretase enzyme class of drugs, were just basically shelved by all the drug companies. And again, because of patient advocacy, they were kind of brought back from the basement, back to life in desmoid tumors. And now there's a whole new repurposing of drugs and a whole new life that has come out from these gamma secretase enzymes. So in summary, I would say, yes, it inhibits the Wnt signaling pathway, but it also inhibits a whole host of other enzymes and in many, many different ways in different cell context.
So Terry, maybe you can comment a little bit on the design here of the DeFi study, phase 3 study with 142 patients. That's what you can do when you have a really good treatment. You can do a phase 3 study with 142 patients. Terry, can you talk about the design and also the thought that went into trying to capture data on quality of life? Because that, to me, was one of the really outstanding things about this trial.
Yeah. One thing that I would like to point about the DeFi trial is that it selected patients who had, I would say, a rather aggressive course. So patients, in order to participate in that trial, were required to have had progression within, you know, the few months that preceded entry to the trial. And that may explain, in my view, why a response rate of 8% to placebo was observed in comparison with about 20% in the sorafenib trial. The interesting thing is that this was obviously a positive trial. You know, you had a nice hazard ratio. You had a response rate of about 40%. And by the end of the trial, most of the patients had not experienced disease progression. toxicity was manageable, fairly predictable. One thing that obviously caught everybody's attention was the ovarian toxicity. But I have to say that it's been somewhat reassuring to see that patients who went off treatment, that their ovarian function seemingly recovered, and that even some patients who decided to stay on the medication, that there was a resolution of that ovarian toxicity.
Yeah, we're going to take a look at that data from ovarian toxicity that was presented at ASCO in a second. But Marinol, do you want to comment a little bit about the lower part of these graphs here that looks at a patient-recorded outcome, including the so-called GADIS symptom score, which was a scale you developed specifically for patients with desmoid? And if you could talk a little bit about what's in the GADIS scale.
Sure, yeah. So, one of the key things I think, takeaway again, is that I think at the very beginning we mentioned that this is a disease where most patients do not die from complications of this disease. There's a very, very small number of people who will die, typically with abdominal desmoid tumors that can cause other issues. So then it goes to the heart of this is that, here we are showing differences in progression-free survival. And from, when we look back, we say, look, progression-free survival or response rates are a proxy to overall survival. But if this is a disease where patients are not dying, then overall survival is a meaningless endpoint. Then how beneficial is a PFS difference? So the question is, well, if you're not changing overall survival, are you making patients feel better? And so when this DeFi study went on, that became really a big heart of the question in the field. And we obviously looked at many different patient-reported outcome measures or quality of life measures. The GADIS itself was again developed in collaboration with my institution, myself, as well as the patient advocacy group DTRF. And this was prospectively developed, particularly for desmoid tumors. Every other questionnaire that we have are sort of general oncology solid tumor questionnaires. But this is one where patients, desmoid tumor patients, were interviewed about their symptoms, find out what is it that was most meaningful to them. And those were the sort of the symptom as well as scale that went into development of this question. So this is the first desmoid tumor specific patient reported outcome that has actually been validated in the DeFi study as well.
So I was really excited when I saw that patient reported outcome and that whole story with the advocacy group. What an incredible story. But Terry, I'm curious too, because we saw some more data just at the ESMO meeting on patient reported outcomes, again, from the DeFi study. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, is this just follow up? And then I was talking to Marinol a little bit more about it when I really started to realize what this is all about. So Marinol, this is another analysis from DeFi, but am I correct in saying instead of looking at everybody, so including the people with objective response, these were people with stable disease?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So these are exactly. So theory, maybe you
so
can.
So I mean, that's an and I just want to point out that from the oncology point of view, breast cancer, SERDs, all the time, we're talking about people who don't progress. Is that really a benefit or not? You all actually went in there and looked at those patients who their tumors weren't growing, they weren't shrinking, and you showed that they felt better. That's the way, at least that's the way I read that. Terry, am I reading that
right?
I
agree. Yeah, I agree. That's a very relevant finding because, we tend to think intuitively that in order for patients to feel better, that the tumor should shrink. And what this graph shows is that you can experience clinical benefit even if your disease remains stable.
I was just pointing out here that this is the stable disease cohort, correct, Myrtle?
Yeah.
That's right.
You looked at the stable disease impact, and then you looked at these various things. You saw those people, even though their tumors weren't increasing, were improving clinically. We'll get to 102 in a second. But I just want to go back and talk a little bit about one other issue, and that is tolerability, toxicity, including ovarian toxicity. that we were just referring to. So first of all, can you talk a little bit about some of the key things that you review with patients who are about to begin nirogacestat in terms of what to expect in terms of toxicity?
Yeah, sure. So I would say that gastrointestinal toxicity in the form of diarrhea, stomatitis, and then some metabolic, I won't say complications, but effects such as, changes in the phosphate level. And then, as with any other medication, you can have sort of non-specific side effects, nausea, fatigue, etc., skin rash. There was the ovarian toxicity, obviously, that requires a discussion of its own in women of childbearing age. As far as we can tell, there is no obvious toxicity to male gonads. The data that we have point to the ovary as a specific toxicity.
So, Myrnal, you had this paper, or this data originally from looking at people who were childbearing in DeFi. And then at the ASCO meeting, as I just mentioned, there was a bunch of new data presented specifically looking at ovarian toxicity. I guess this came out of an ASCO initiative, or maybe it was NCCN, but an initiative about the issue of looking for ovarian toxicity in general in clinical trials. And then this presentation was trying to match up what ASCO said you should do when you do a trial in premenopausal women with what was actually done here, which was pretty much what they suggested. So can you talk about, I don't know if this is going to be the new wave that all trials that have premenopausal women are going to need to pull these data moving forward. I'd be curious to know if you think that is the case. But anyhow, what did they just report here, Myrnal?
I mean, I think it's a couple of things. One is, we used to call this ovarian insufficiency or ovarian failure. There was a lot of back and forth on what is the right semantics. But ultimately, I think the FDA and perhaps even ASCO came out saying that the correct terminology here is ovarian toxicity. So that's a new language that we're all using to describe this. And again, as Thierry said, in the clinical trial, the ovarian toxicity was really unanticipated. This was a signal that was seen on study. The study was halted. The FDA was notified. The study was amended. Patients re-signed consent. And then with enough sort of, close monitoring, patients were re-enrolled or continue to be enrolled. And I think the big takeaway here is that it seems that when you stop the gamma secretase inhibitor, most patients, most women of childbearing potential recover their ovarian toxicity and they're back to normal. There are some patients, even while they're on the drug, they initially have some irregularities and then they recover that as well. And then there's a handful of patients who were at the time that data was reported, they still happened to be on the drug and that was hard to interpret. But all of this is to just gather more data on a new signal with this class of drugs that had not been appreciated previously. For main reason, I think, is because most of the gamma secretase inhibitors were studied in women who are postmenopausal, older, as well as who may have been previously heavily treated with standard cytotoxic chemotherapy. So this was a signal that was much more appreciated because it was done in a younger patient population.
So I want to go on and hear a little bit more about your cases, but just final comment back to Terry in terms of this ovarian toxicity issue. Whenever I think about ovarian function, the first person I think about is Ann Partridge from your institution in breast cancer, who's had such a leading role in premenopausal breast cancer. She did the incredible positive study that showed it was safe to get pregnant after breast cancer, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't remember her using the term ovarian toxicity. So I got to talk to her and see what she thinks about this new wave. I'm sure she's going to be very supportive of getting more data. I would think, you have trials with Hodgkin lymphoma, et cetera, with young women, et cetera. It really seems like something that is worth focusing on. Any final comment about this before we get back to your cases, Terry?
Well, I think that a reassuring thing is the fact that ovarian toxicity in most cases seems to be reversible. Okay. Certainly in patients who have stopped the drug, but even in many patients who have decided to stay on it. I mean, that doesn't mean that we should not be cautious, but that's certainly a reassuring finding.
Just one final point before we get to the cases, though. I was asking both of you about how you approach the issue of birth control in your premenopausal patients on Nyro. Myrnal, would you like to comment on that?
I mean, this drug, nirogacestat, which impacts so many different pathways in the cell, including, you know, the Notch and Wnt, which are extremely, extremely critical and important in embryogenesis. So warn patients that as long as they're on a drug like this, or even other drugs like TKIs or chemotherapy, but particularly this drug, I tell them that they do need to have contraception, if they're sexually active, with ideally a two barrier contraception. So that's been my approach, with patients, that it's really,
Do not, yes. So we talked a lot about systemic therapy. I love this case that you've got here, Myrnal, this 43-year-old lady who got transarterial chemoembolization with doxorubicin beads. What happened with her?
Yeah, so this is a patient who had this pretty large desmoid tumor, you could say, of the paraspinal area or her flank. Causing a lot of pain, great difficulty sitting down, crossing legs, being active. So she went on one of the gamma secretase inhibitor clinical trials. She was on it for about 3 to 6 months, didn't have much benefit. Tumor didn't get better, her symptoms also, and she didn't have too many side effects either. At which point she decided to say, you know what, I just want to take some time off and see what happens. So she took about 9 months off, and when she came back, her tumor was nearly double the size, and she was in a lot more pain. And again, we talked about liposomal doxorubicin, we talked about sorafenib, methotrexate, all the usual options. And she didn't want anything systemic, and she says, is there something that I can try that is localized? And I think at the very beginning of this podcast, I said, you know, we really should not be going after localized therapies such as surgery. And I said, you know, we could certainly try some sort of a transarterial chemoembolization. And the only reason I suggested this and encouraged the patient to explore it is we happen to have a interventional radiologist who has tremendous experience in treating these tumors in these unusual locations with complex nerve and blood vessel involvement. This is not something that most interventional radiologists can comfortably treat or even safely treat. So I think in the hands of an experienced interventional radiologist who has a lot of experience treating desmoid tumors, I think it's a reasonable option to take. So the patient went, and essentially what they do is they find an artery that feeds into the desmoid tumor, and then they inject these liposomal doxorubicin beads into it. And what you can see here is a month later, the entire tumor has become necrotic. And time will tell, but the patient already feels a whole lot better. The tumor is softer. She can sit on it, less pain, increased mobility as well.
So, Terry, any comments about this case? Have you had any patients get this kind of a therapy? And also another thing that I've been hearing from you all is the fact that, and you can see this in any tumor, but it sounds like maybe more common where you get a response, but the dimensions, I mean, I'm not saying this is different, this, you know, vascular, but that you can get a response and the dimensions of the desmoid doesn't change, but the way it looks on scan is different. It looks different. And that's kind of a response. Any comments, Terry?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, we said that we have moved away from surgery as a first approach, but there are situations where because of the size or the location or the patient preference, where some form of local therapy would be desirable. And there are such therapies that have been developed, such as cryoembolization. there's a cryoablation or chemoembolization.
So there is another GSI that's been in development. I heard a little bit about it when we met before, Myrnal, and we saw some more data again at ESMO. I don't know if it has a name yet, AL102. It needs a name. I like the name of the trial, though, Ringside. Anyhow, what do we know about AL102? Does it have a name yet? And how is it from at this point? Is it different than nirogacestat?
Yeah, no, this still is just called AL102. And similar to nirogacestat, which was investigated, shelved, and then resurrected, this is a drug that was also shelved and then resurrected or repurposed in this rare disease condition. You know, the clinical trial itself is practically near identical to the one that, to the DeFi study. The only differentiator between the Ringside as well as the DeFi compounds is that this is given once a day and the nirogacestat is given twice a day. To me, that's the biggest difference. Beyond that, I think it's not appropriate to cross-compare these trials to say, is this one drug better than the other? I think once the phase 3, which is already now complete, we're just waiting for the final, you know, the top-line data to emerge to really see how this shakes up.
Terry, any thoughts about this agent and whether it might have a future?
You know, I mean, this trial is not going to compare AL102 to the medication we already have, which is nirogacestat. So it will not really be possible to see which one is better, which one is safer. But I think that it will bring useful information. And if it gets approved, as I said earlier, we'll have more choice for our patients.
So let's see if we can get into a couple more cases here. 38-year-old woman, sounds like maybe interesting in terms of being maybe possibly a premenopausal woman. That'd be interesting. With a large groin desmoid tumor, Myrnal, what happened?
Yeah, so this is a elementary school teacher with two young kids of her own with this large groin desmoid tumor. She was having problems bending, picking up her kids, doing chores, and was just sort of in general discomfort, trouble sleeping. And the tumor also grew because initially we did take this, let's just observe and see what happens kind of an approach, because she was about 2.5 years away from her last child. So we said, maybe it's pregnancy related. Let's just give it some time. It's not in any threatening location. And it just kept growing and growing. She went initially on liposomal doxorubicin, developed an allergic reaction, infusion reaction. It was quite severe, and she got too jittery and did not want to try it again. Then she went on sorafenib and had all kinds of issues, primarily hypertension. She went on two meds, didn't help, stopped, had other skin issues as well. And then finally she went on nirogacestat. And she was on the drug for nearly 2 years or so. She was started at the 150 milligrams twice daily dose, but then ended up having some skin reactions, primarily this hidradenitis suppurativa, which is almost, you know, this it's like this infection of the hair follicles that can be very painful, and we do know that that's directly a cause of the drug. So because of those reactions and other things, we had to dose reduce, and she had a very good quality of life. She did have her menstrual cycle stop, so she did have ovarian toxicity. After 2 years, and as you can see, a dramatic shrinkage in the size of the tumor, and the inside of the tumor also has become completely collagenized, we kept watching her, and now she's a while out. Her tumor is completely burnt out. She probably doesn't need any more treatment at all. And the good news is that her menstrual cycle has completely returned back to normal. Her symptoms have improved, her pain's improved, and she is working full-time as an elementary school teacher.
Terry, any comments on this case?
No, I think that this is a very eloquent demonstration of what our therapies can do for this tumor.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any people from that support group watching this thing tonight, but you know, you hear a case like that, and there's a human being that really benefited by that incredible effort that was done. All right, let's see if we can just squeeze in one more case. Another young woman, 30 years old, Terry, what happened with her?
So she was a patient who had a history of hypothyroidism that was well controlled, and she underwent minor surgery for what was thought to be a lipoma outside the United States. And unfortunately, the specimen was apparently not sent to pathology. And then she noticed that the tumor was growing back. And according to her, within 3 months only, the tumor had reached the size from, you know, let's say a scar to 11 centimeters or more. And when I saw her, that mass was very painful. It prevented her from laying down. So clearly, that patient needed to be treated. And I did the same thing, went over the options with her. It was biopsied, of course, and you know, a desmoid was diagnosed. And it was obvious that she needed to be treated. And we usually tend to see our patients in a multidisciplinary fashion, even if surgery tends to be off the table for most cases. But that patient was seen by me and a surgeon in the same clinic. And we agreed that surgery didn't make sense because of the extent of the operation that would be needed, with no guarantee that there would not be further relapse. We talked about radiation therapy, which we tend to use much less than before. And this time the concern was that it was a large field that would lead to a lot of scarring, fibrosis. And we decided to go for systemic treatment options. She preferred strongly on oral treatment so that she could, you know, stay at home with her family. And she had heard through patient groups about the ovarian toxicity data and was seriously concerned about that. So we settled on sorafenib, which she has been tolerating extremely well, and which has resulted in the a change of the tumor. Not so much, I would say, in width and length, but thickness, if I may say. So she also has had a good evolution.
So any comments, Myrna, on this case?
Yeah, I just want to quickly add that, you know, the best way to evaluate most desmoid tumors is ideally whenever possible is with an MRI scan. And I think what the MRI provides is something called the looking at the T2 signal. And I think you have to ask the radiologist to specifically comment on the desmoid's changing T2 signal. What the T2 signal essentially shows is how much of this is has water content and how much of this is transitioning from a cellular desmoid, an active cellular desmoid, to an inactive collagenous desmoid tumor. And the T2 signal in MRI is a very nice indicator to show for treatment response, even when these tumors don't necessarily shrink. And we see this with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, with Doxil, with gamma secretase inhibitors. We see this really with any kind of a treatment response. So I think for the practitioners who are looking at this, you have to keep that in mind, as there are other ways to look at benefits of treatment beyond just looking at dimension. Looking at what's looking inside the tumor is also a very valuable way to gauge, are we benefiting or not benefiting?
So Terry and Marinal, thank you so much for working with us tonight. I always love talking about this topic. It's so interesting. We could continue on and on, but thank you so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Terry. Thanks,
thank Marinal. You very much for the invitation.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.